Well, hello everybody. Today I'd like to welcome Janet E. Kroon to the show. Jan holds a bachelor's degree in political science, modern European history, and Russian language and area studies from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and a master's degree in international studies from the University of Dayton. She taught international baccalaureate history for nearly two decades for Fairfax County Public Schools and developed a deep interest in the Civil War by living in Northern Virginia. Today we'll be discussing her book, The War Outside My Window, The Civil War Diary of Leroy Wiley Gresham, 1860 to 1865. Now before we get rolling, let me implore you to use your better judgment and head over to theroguehistorian.com to subscribe to this show. And while you're at it, please leave me a rating and a comment. I love to hear from my listeners. You can also follow me on Twitter at @mkeithharris and Instagram at @keithharrishistory. Okay, let's welcome Jan to the show. Great. Jan, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's really great to see you.
Nice to see you too. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Now, you are the editor of The War Outside My Window, The Civil War Diary of Leroy. And how do we pronounce his middle name? Wiley?
Wiley, yeah.
We're going to go with Wiley, right? Leroy Wiley Gresham, 1860 to 1865. Now, tell us, how did you happen to encounter this diary and what compelled you to have these several volumes published?
I love this story. I was introduced to Leroy on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I was at home and I was scrolling through Facebook and this article... It was written by a journalist on the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And he was writing about the Library of Congress and their holdings they brought out for the sesquicentennial of the war. And this it came every day for 3 days. And finally, the third day, I said, okay, I'm going to read this. And I'm a secondary teacher, advanced high school social studies. And the first thing I thought was when I was reading this article was how awesome it would be to use this in a classroom with kids. He made it sound real interesting, and it was day to day, which is one of its unique qualities. And it was a kid writing for himself, and he seemed to be just a really nice, interesting kid with a lot of issues in his life. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be a great way to engage kids who are reluctant to read. Sometimes if you can get them interested in someone their age from that time period, mm-hmm. that will hook them. And so I read the article. I went on and looked at Library of Congress and saw what they had on their website. They digitized all seven volumes. And I thought it was really awesome and really different. I contacted Ted Savas and he said he'd never heard of it. And he contacted other people he knows in academia and in publishing. They'd never heard of it either. So we decided to go for it.
Isn't it fantastic when you find something like that no one's ever heard of in the archives? And it's just so illuminating in so many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, it is great. I've found stuff and I've published a collection of letters on my website, for example, that is like that. And it's just so revealing, it provides so many insights into a particular person's life. And a person from a very privileged background in this particular
yes.
case. Mm-hmm. Leroy is a privileged young man, and that's something that I wanted to talk to you about. If you were to place him on the socioeconomic spectrum, in where would you put him, and what does this tell us about his life? And should you think that we should go into reading his diary with any set of assumptions about him?
No, I don't. Just answer that one first. I don't think you should go into assumptions about it, because I think this book kind of blows some assumptions apart. It, in my opinion, anyway, it gets us insight into things that people are not used to seeing. I would put him at the top of the socioeconomic scale, mm-hmm. because his family is wealthy. His father had been judged twice in the 1850s, mayor of Macon.
Macon, Georgia, Southerner. We should probably put that up there.
Yeah, mayor in Macon, Georgia. Mm-hmm. They elected mayors every year there. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of political pull. when they decided to build a new town hall, they made it a one-man project and handed the whole thing over to John Gresham, Leroy's father. Mm-hmm. He found the site. He decided what architecturally it was going to look like. He figured out what the who the builders were going to be. He basically pulled the whole thing together. You don't get to do that if you don't have a lot of clout. They were, at one point at the beginning, it kind of tickled me, you know, Leroy's family, he's talking about his day-to-day things and he writes, oh, I forgot to write that father got a new buggy a couple of weeks ago. It's like getting a new car mm-hmm. for a family. And he kind of forgets to write about it. You know, it's kind of a significant thing for a lot of people, but it was just kind of an, oh yeah, dad got a new car. And so it was like, no huge deal. They were slave owners. Mm-hmm. They had, the way it worked in Macon is most of the wealthy families lived in town like the Greshams did. They had two plantations, which after I did some land studies with the help of the University of Georgia Library, found out that the two plantations they had were side by side, about 35 miles south and east in Houston County. It's not Houston County. It's Houston County.
That's right.
Yeah. So when I first started reading it, I'm like, wait a minute, they've got plantations in Houston. Isn't that a little far? But that was a one day wagon ride. So not really too far for them, but that's where the plantation where the wealth was held. They had about 90 some people based on the 1860 census on those two plantations. They had full-time overseers and the family was up in Macon and they would go down occasionally, the father and the older brother, Thomas in particular. So they had 7-8 people in the household permanently mm-hmm. and you get to know those people. It's hard to work with those census bits of information because the Schedule B, which is the enslaved population, doesn't give you any names. You only get the gender, the age, and the degree of color. Mm-hmm. So you don't know who's who. And all these people that come up from Houston, you don't know exactly which plantation each one belongs to, how they're related to one another, or any of that. But you get to know the people that live in the household really well. And you can put the names to the different people that were in the census because he writes about them every day.
You know, it's and I wanted to speak to you about the enslaved people that move in and out of the story. I really wanted to ask you what insights, I mean, we talk about assumptions and we talk about the, you know, arrangements between Black people and white people. And you say that this collection, you know, kind of blows some of the assumptions out of the water. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if this is one of the assumptions that maybe we go into this book reading. What insights does Leroy's diary offer about the relationship between the privileged white people in the story and the enslaved Black people in the story?
I think the relationship are close ones. Mm-hmm. You always hear it's kind of the Simon Legree, you know, they're always beating their slaves and everything. You don't hear any of that. There's only one instance where Leroy talks about his mother getting angry at one of the maids and slapping her, and that's at the very end, where life is totally falling apart for these privileged people. You hear about one of the housemaids being whisked out of the house in the middle of the night, and Leroy doesn't know why. And the next day he finds out that her sister who lived on the plantation was dying. And his parents wanted to make sure she could get down and see her, mm-hmm. her sister before she died. They used the same doctor that they used for their son to take care of a minor epidemic down in the plantation. It took the doctor down there for a few days. They seemed to really, really care about these people, and they live together. I mean, they're a part of each other's lives. Mm-hmm. They're intertwined. They're not really separate. And that was one sense that I got, is that it's, I wouldn't say it's one big happy family, but there's relationships that are built there. Mm-hmm. Leroy is, he talks about the cook, Mary, having all the kids, his older brother, Thomas, and his younger sister, Minnie, and himself going into the kitchen and doing a candy pull or baking cookies. Nondescripts are his favorites. And she will do things like that. When she goes shopping, she'll get him an orange as a special treat, and things like that.
But I'm wondering though, do they still? I mean, the white people in this story, they must you know have an understanding of their relationship as master and slave.
Yes, obviously that they do. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it doesn't come across. Of course, we're looking through the eyes of a boy who's 12 to 17. Mm-hmm. That may not be that, you know, we look at it as adults and as historians, we look at that in a very particular way. He may not look at it that way because that was the way things had always been.
Right. And that's an interesting point. And it was a question that I wanted, it's a great segue into my next question. This is a primary source. And I tell my students about primary sources all the time and how we have to read primary sources for biases and for, you know, worldviews. Mm-hmm. Which he clearly has one, being from, you know, a privileged background as he is. And this is also a diary, which is a very particular kind of primary source in that, you know, diaries aren't generally intended for publication and they're not generally intended for other people to read. And so one of the questions that I as you've gotten to know Leroy probably better than anybody else outside of his immediate family. Do you think that he is, when he's writing in his diary, do you think that he's being truthful to himself? Or do you think that he is, you know, writing his diary in a way that, you know, sort of places himself in the best possible light? I mean, we like to write good things about ourselves. It's difficult, I think, for some people to be self-critical or, to even be honest with oneself. I have journals that I scratch out my, ramblings in, from time to time. And I look back at them and I go, was I really being honest with myself, 3 years ago when I wrote this? So do you think that he's being honest with himself and accurately portraying his worldview?
I think he mostly is. I think he might skip over some things. Some things I found out about the family, for example, through other sources. I think he wants to put himself in a good light. One thing that struck me is a family with an older brother and a younger sister. There's no sibling rivalry. Mm-hmm. I have a younger brother. We still have sibling rivalry.
Yeah, tell me about it.
But there's none of that in there. So it's a very happy, loving family, which I'm sure they were. But I think he minimizes some of the more negative things, mm-hmm. Just because he may not want to have to deal with it. And this is a kid who's dealing with a lot of extra stuff that the average person of that time period doesn't deal with. Mm-hmm. He's struggling. Not only is he watching a war take over and totally change his community, but he's got his own internal battles that he's going through as well. Mm-hmm. So I think he's very truthful about those. I think brutally honest about those. Some of the others, maybe not quite as much, but I'm thinking about extant letters that I've just been able to scratch the surface of. And I think he was trying to make a sunnier face on what he was writing in there.
That's an interesting point too. I mean, I think whenever I read diaries, I'm always aware of that tendency, I think, for people to want to put the sunniest, put the sunniest side of what's going on. Now, you mentioned that he's got some internal struggles, some personal struggles. And of course he does. The great tragedy of book, of course, is that he is dying slowly and painfully, as it were. And we know right? We know from the very beginning mm-hmm. that this is the end of those. So I'm not giving anything away here. This isn't a spoiler. Right. This is something that we know right out of the gate. You write about it in the introduction. And he doesn't know, or at least it seems as if he doesn't know. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that he understands that things are more serious than he tends to let on? Though he does talk about things seriously, for sure. But why doesn't he know really kind of for sure? And do you think there's something going on with his parents and his physicians who aren't telling him these things?
I think they are not telling him the whole truth. Mm-hmm. I think because he is, and they love this kid. I mean, I fell in love with this kid. Mm-hmm. I imagined him in the classroom with my contemporary students and always wondered, oh, how we would do. They love their child and they want to keep him around as long as possible. And I think, I have an older daughter who has gone through some significant health issues, mm-hmm. both as a small child and then as a young adult. And I can tell you, it's hard to know what's going on with them when they don't quite get it. Mm-hmm. And I think they just didn't tell him the whole story. And when I was transcribing it, I didn't know the depths of this because he doesn't know. He's not writing you and writing down and saying, oh, this happened, so that means I've got 6 months to live. 6 months out, he's trying to figure out what he's going to do with his adult life. And you're reading this and it's heart-wrenching because you know he doesn't have much more time. Mm-hmm. He talks in great detail about his younger sister, who is very academically gifted. She later in her life was a published author in her own right. She was asked to read her junior thesis paper aloud to the community, which for a girl in that time period, that was probably one of the few times that a young lady could be intellectually who she was in open and not have to hide her opinions. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge honor for Minnie to be asked to do this. And he writes about the whole process from buying pencils to she's doing revisions and you go through the whole thing with her. He's so proud of her. And then he writes about when she gives her presentation in the auditorium in town, all the slaves from the family are in there listening to her. His parents are in there. Everybody who's anybody is in there listening. And he's outside listening. And I'm like, wait a minute. He's not in there, and why is he on the outside listening? He tells you the time she starts, how long she spoke, how proud he was of her, but he's not in there. Now, he got around town a lot using a wagon. Mm-hmm. Wheelchairs were actually a byproduct of the Civil War. He doesn't have a wheelchair. He's got a specialized wagon that he's in, and I'm thinking, well, maybe it doesn't fit in there, but then when you get to the end, and you realized what it is that's killing him, you understand why he could not go in that crowded auditorium. But he doesn't question this. He doesn't ask questions about why he's no longer going to school. He seems to be mostly self-educated. Mm-hmm. He's incredibly bright. Fantastic.
And well-read, too.
Best player. Mm-hmm. He read Shakespeare for fun. Mm-hmm. I don't speak Latin. Give me something in German and I'm good to go. Mm-hmm. But I have one of the Latin teachers at my school work with the Latin quotations. And she said there was one that she didn't quite understand. She thought maybe it was an older version of Latin. And I'm like, there's older versions of Latin. That's a new one. But I said, would it help you to know that this is a young man who plays with words in English, mm-hmm. writes things backwards, puts little messages in code? And she goes, yeah, he's playing with words in Latin. So he's incredibly bright.
Latin's already confusing enough, by the way. I took Latin in college, and Latin's already super confusing. So to be able to do that, it's actually pretty remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just playing abilities. If you've watched on Netflix recently, Queen's Gambit.
Mm-hmm.
They make references to one of his heroes of the time period.
Mm-hmm.
And I see him going, wow, I wonder if he was playing at, you know, at that level at the beginning, and because he loved it so much. I mean, they transcribe entire games. He got to the point where the only person who could, only people who could challenge him mathematically was his brother and a young man named Jim Edwards. And they would send math problems across town to one another and see how long it would take them to solve it. So I see these servants running back and forth across Macon with this pieces of paper with scary math on them. you know, when Jim
I'm breaking out in hives just thinking about it.
I know. Yeah, same here. This is why I you know, I'm not going to be a math teacher. I'm a history
yeah,
teacher.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, humanities.
No math
for me. Is that common for history teachers, by the way? Because every time I meet somebody who does, you know, is in my profession, it's always the same story. You know, it's like we were never really good at that stuff. You know, we were great with the abstract stuff, the history, the English. We're good with that stuff. The math.
Yeah, I think it kind of is. I think mm-hmm. it kind of is. Although I will say I have 1 year of PhD work in political science and mm-hmm. I aced all my statistics classes. So go figure.
I did well in statistics too. You know, that's the funny thing, because I guess that is the, I thought, you know, I had to take one of those, an upper division math class in college, right? And statistics was the one that, we're totally getting off track here, but this is actually kind of interesting. Statistics was the one thing that seemed to me like it would make sense for a history major to understand, because we read, you know, we read data and we read all these, you know, population growth and you mm-hmm. know, and all this kind of stuff. We talk about the kind of stuff all the time. So statistics actually, you know, matter to us. So maybe that's it. Maybe because we figured out a way to apply it to our discipline.
Right. And I don't think it's like real math anyway.
Well, if I remember correctly,
rationalize it to myself.
This is like you know, a bazillion years ago for me, but it seemed like there were like four or five formulas, and you had to just figure out how the problem fit into each one of these formulas, and then you were good to go. That's all I can remember about statistics. But anyway, mathematicians are probably listening to this, you know, getting shaking their fists and getting very frustrated right now with both of us.
Well, yeah, that is kind of common, but you know, and it's so those abilities. I mean, he was exceptionally bright,
mm-hmm.
but I think his parents wanted to keep him around, so they didn't tell him the severity of his disease. And again, as I'm reading through this, every so often I would check in with Ted Savas,
mm-hmm.
and he'd go, "Well, have you found out what his disease is?" And I'm like, "Well, no, I haven't, because all I can think of is he has night coughing, and I'm asthmatic. I have a kid both my daughters are asthmatic to different degrees, and night coughing is very common with asthmatics.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd had a leg injury early on when he was 8 years old, and then other things start happening to him. So when we meet him, he is off to go see the most premier doctor in the United States, who is actually the first doctor to practice what we now call plastic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not able to do much for Leroy. He said, "I can't really help you. Here's another bottle of medicine to try." And I think what his father wanted, because Leroy had, as the Washington Post author wrote, he had bed sores. They weren't bed sores. They were lesions. They were mm-hmm. abscesses where the disease was going, exiting his body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're nasty. It's, you know, it's disease. It's not pleasant. Right. Had to be cleaned constantly. Probably didn't smell very good. It was very uncomfortable for the child. And I think his father wanted this plastic surgeon to close this up.
Mm-hmm.
And he told him, no, he couldn't do it. This is my imagination here. Doctor said he couldn't do it. He had to, the way this disease works, this stuff has to get out of his body somehow. We close this up, it's going to, one, cause him more pain, and two, it's going to come out somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So the best thing is to have him lay down, be comfortable, and do the best that he can. And so at 12 years of age, that's his diagnosis. Of course, again, that's looking backward with hindsight after we figured out what it was killing him.
Mm-hmm.
And even to do that, we had to get Dr. Dennis Rosbach, who is another one of Ted's authors, who's a surgeon, I pulled all the medical information from my electronic document, sent it up to Dr. Rosbach. 2 weeks later, he came back with his diagnosis. Mm. And what he had was a, what we consider a very rare form of tuberculosis. Mm. Now, TB, the commonality, the common conception is you cough politely into a white handkerchief and you come up with what? Mm-hmm. Blood. He never had that as a symptom. He never coughed up blood. He coughed up other stuff, but never coughed up blood. So that would have clued me off if he'd been coughing up blood. But he had what's called spinal tuberculosis, which I didn't even know existed. Mm-hmm. It's present in many third world countries. I even have one of my own physicians who's from Pakistan, and he says, oh yes, it's very common where I'm from. It's generally people who get to their doctor too late. They live too far away and they have no regular medical care, or they can't afford the treatments. Mm. And that's what was killing this little boy. And then when you know that, then you can see as he progresses through this disease and he gets, you know, it's, I had one person at a, Civil War roundtable tell me that Shakespeare himself could not have written a more perfect tragedy, mm-hmm. because as the South is dying, so is Leroy. Mm-hmm. The parallels are just incredible. So you see, you know, disease and medical treatment of the time period. You can see the family dynamic. The only people who ever worked with his back, besides the doctors, were his parents, his grandmother, and his older brother, nobody else. You see how the war shapes this community, how it tears families apart. You see the economics of it. I worked with a friend who's an eighth grade English teacher in New Hampshire who works with Common Core. Virginia, we don't have Common Core. Mm-hmm. And we put together curriculum guide to go with the book,
which is very good, by the way. I have that here. This is a super useful addition to the book. It really kind of helps bring a lot of the ideas to light.
Yeah, thank you. We worked hard on that, framing mm-hmm. from two different angles, trying to make it, you know, teacher friendly. We mm-hmm. thought about, you know, what a first year teacher, what could they use with it. But one of the lessons I wrote was about the economics. Leroy loves fruit. He's got a sweet tooth. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the prices of different things as this Confederate economy starts to really decline. Everything starts to get exponentially more expensive. And there's a whole lesson using statistics like we talked about before.
There it is. Having the kids,
having the kids look at basic statistics. Mm-hmm. I have a similar lesson I did with my seniors with the Marshall Plan, mm-hmm. Using different data points, trying to figure out why certain countries were allotted certain amounts of money for the Marshall Plan. And this is just basic to show how much more things are costing when the Confederate currency is being devalued. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's all sorts of different things that happen in here. Some things that are contemporary, the same day that they had the bread riots in Richmond, Macon had a fabric riot. Women went into the store and they were stealing bolts of fabric because they couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. And John Gresham was the president of the local cotton mill, and he came up with a scheme. Everybody had pork. Pork was the protein base of the Southern economy. And if the women would give him a pound of pork, he would give them a yard of fabric, cotton good. And when he had all this pork, the poorest people, he gave it back to them. He took the rest of the surplus pork and he sold it to the Army of the Tennessee. Yeah. So you see all these kinds of things happening, people coming in and out of the house that are incredibly interesting. Leroy's favorite general is in the community. I won't spoil that story. It's a priceless one.
Well, you know, it's actually, I have a question about that. But you don't have to give it away. That's fine. That's fine. We have to keep some secrets, you know.
I won't tell you who his first girlfriend is either. So.
Okay.
First crush. No.
Don't want to blow that for him either. Let's talk about the war, though. Do you find that LeRoy is a Confederate nationalist? And do you think that his youth colors the way that he looks at, you know, whether his commitment or his lack of commitment to the Confederate cause?
I think he is a Confederate nationalist, as his father was. Mm-hmm. Again, mm-hmm. teaching teenagers, you know, during election years, maybe not this year, I don't know, I'm not in the classroom anymore. But the ninth graders kind of repeat, they parrot what their parents think. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough that I would get those kids back in 12th grade. And by then they developed their own concepts and their own ideas and could explain why. LeRoy does the same thing. The beginning, he's saying, my father says this. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what he believes. And at the end, he'll, in his diary, he'll say he disagrees with his father very reluctantly. And he explains why he disagrees on certain aspects, certain goals of the war, benchmarks, if you will. I think he is a nationalist. I think he knows that the South is different from the North. And again, the whole cause of the war is so much more than slavery. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot too. And his father being a businessman, he may be hearing those insights that maybe a lot of other people wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Because his father is dealing with cotton, with tariff, with, you know, having to get product out of the Confederate state or the Southern states and then other products. And it was very complicated. So I think that's part of it. He talks about abolitionists at the beginning, but I don't think he's talking about it. It's just a label.
Does he look at abolitionism as something that is just sort of stirring the pot, you know, extremists that are causing problems? And
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my sense.
Do you think that he associates the rest of the, I mean, it's sometimes it's hard, you know, to get exact insights here, but do you think that he associates the rest of the Republican Party, as many of the newspapers did, with abolitionism?
That I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a hard time getting that as well. I know that a lot of people did, you know, sort of lump all of the Republican Party in together under one, you know, sort of one faction of the Republican Party. Of course, we know that most Republicans are pretty moderate on this issue. And that the abolitionists were a small faction. But I think it makes a lot of people nervous. Because, you know, their voice is definitely amplified in the press and various other places. So I do think that makes, you know, including all the other issues. I mean, I often think that, you know, when I teach my students this, it's like, you know, in the beginning, you know, with the issue of slavery kind of tearing the country apart and the territories and you know, people having a conflicting vision about what the future of the country would look like, you know, they see each other as different people, Southerners and Northerners. And I often think that they do. With different ideas, different ways of life, different understandings of, you know, honor and various other things. And so that, I think, also complicates the whole thing, you know.
Yes.
They feel as if
sectionalism. I mean, we even today, I think there's sectionalism today to a certain degree.
Oh, I think it's state by state. When I was from, and I'm from Alabama, everybody knows that. And I grew up in California, of course, but I remember my grandmother giving grief to people in Georgia because she called them Yankee-fied. Talking about Atlanta. In Atlanta, they're Yankee-fied there. And I went, oh, okay.
I went to a teacher enrichment thing. Mm-hmm. It was held in Richmond. It was about Virginia in the early 20th century, and I was the only teacher from Fairfax County to be there. And one of the older gentlemen who was there, who came from Prince Edward County, which was the last county in Virginia to desegregate, he said, "Well, you come from occupied Northern Virginia, and you got everything, you know, the rest of the state, we're not like you." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's great. I grew up in the Chicago area. And Chicago is not the rest of the state of Illinois either. So it was, you know, quite common. But the traveling that I've done with this book, I have found that the conflicts and the hurt, the historic memory, if you will, in the South, it's very different than the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. It's still very, very strong there. And even though I was born in Alabama also.
Where are you now? Whereabouts?
Yeah, I was born in Mobile.
Oh, Mobile. Okay, yeah, I'm from Birmingham. So we're, from different parents, but yeah.
Well, my parents, I was adopted. My parents actually lived in Fairfield.
Gotcha.
But we went to Chicago area when I was about 4 and a half.
Fairfield, Alabama.
Yeah,
that's my family's from Fairfield, Alabama. This is amazing coincidence. Yeah,
my
grandfather worked for U.S. Steel right there in the Fairfield Works. My mom went to Fairfield High School. I lived my grandparents lived on Valley Road there. If you know the region, and my house was on 45th Street, close by there. So wow.
No, my dad was one of the chief auditors for U.S. Steel.
No kidding. Well, how
and they
about
moved that? Him to Gary plant so they could work on the Sears building.
Wow. Coincidence.
Yeah, huh? That's why we left. My parents are from the North and they loved Alabama.
Yeah.
They loved Alabama. And they eventually retired to Florida. They felt very comfortable there. But yeah, I don't remember it very much, but leaving when I was 4 and a half.
Yeah.
But I always felt, kind of a connection, hearing the stories and everything was really interesting. But I think there are differences between, different parts of the country. Even when I was teaching American history, I would talk about the geographic realities of the Northeast and then the breadbasket, of Pennsylvania, New York, and then going from Virginia south, just the soil itself lent to a different way of growing as a society. You could not grow things in the South where one family could very easily feel comfortable and wealthy growing for themselves like you could in New England.
Mm-hmm.
You just couldn't do it, which is why slavery was something that in order to be prosperous, you had to have a lot of people working the rice or the indigo or the cotton. Mm-hmm. Or the tobacco in Virginia.
Right.
So it goes back. Wait, and the kids would look at you like, really? I said, yeah, really. The ground that you walk on, I mean, that is pivotal in the development of society and economy and political structure, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, it's always fun to watch them when they make all those connections.
Yeah, and they go, oh.
How about the dirt? Really? The dirt? I used to have a whole lesson on the difference between the dirt in iron rich, in the deep South and the iron rich dirt there and the dirt in New England with rocks and the soil and various other things. And I stopped doing that just because I think the kids went to sleep, but we did. We did talk about, soil and differences and various other things. One of the other things that I teach my kids is when we talk about the Civil War is the profound connection between the battlefield and the home front, especially
yes.
when we're dealing with two democratic republics at war with each other here, that actually makes a difference when the people behind the lines, the white people anyway, in this case, have a say yes. in who's elected and who's making the calls, who's calling the shots.
Right.
Do you get, a sense from Leroy's writings that, does his morale go up and down along with the ebb and flow on the battlefield when there's reports
Absolutely.
Of victory and losses?
Absolutely, yeah. Especially when you're talking about some of the things in the Tennessee theater, going up and down and up and down. He has a lot of relatives that he's very close to that are with the Army of Northern Virginia, so a lot of his personal worries are with people who are in that theater. But he's very concerned. Like Vicksburg was horrible because it looks like they're winning one day and then the next week, it's terrible. So it's up and down and up and down. And then, it's all Vicksburg. And then he says that Mr. Clisby, who was the editor of the paper, again, all these prominent people are coming in and out of this house. So I think he was very politically astute, even though he wasn't writing it as fully in his diary. He knew that the Army of Virginia, Northern Virginia, had moved over the Potomac again. He wanted to know if Robert E. Lee, General Lee, had been engaged. And Mr. Clisby says, and this is on the 7th of July of 1863, he says, well, there's been a little skirmish, and I don't think it's going to matter too much. It's in a little town called Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. And I pull that quote out when I do my PowerPoint presentations, and the people that are aware of the dates, that's 4 days after the war, that battle had ended.
Right.
And they still don't know. Just the way of getting news, newspapers are spotty. Macon has telegraph, which, you know, that's why I asked Mr. Clisby, because Mr. Clisby had the telegraph.
Yeah.
He could access, so he knew what was going on. That was important. Getting information was not easy. Finding out which relatives had been killed in the war. He had two uncles killed in Texas. They lived in Texas. They'd relocated there and they died there. You'd had one uncle who was wounded at Second Manassas, so he did not go to Antietam. He had another uncle whose hand was pretty much blown up at Antietam.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the more prominent people in Macon, one of them was killed at Antietam. And these women were, okay, I'm gonna go up and get the body. And you're thinking to yourself, of course, hindsight being 20/20, how are you gonna find one body out of all of that death at Antietam? How are you gonna manage to bring back that body? That was very important in that time period, having a good death. And Drew Gilpin Faust has written about that. The documentary Death in the Civil War is probably real accessible for kids to understanding about how death and dying change as a result of the war. So, and this becomes part of Leroy's story as well. But what happens on the battlefield, everybody wants to know. It's often some of the other people who I've gotten to know who have read Leroy's diary say that they forget about that aspect. They're writing about battles. They're writing about armies or particular, you know, personalities. They're not realizing what this conflict is doing to the people back home.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, one of the values of this diary is that you watch this very prominent family who's at the top of everything, political, social, economic. They are at the very tip top of society in Macon. And by the time this thing ends, they don't know where their wealth is going to come from. John Gresham, Leroy's father, wants to buy him a nutritious meal, and he procures a steak by using family silver.
Hmm.
That's how he gets the son a nutritious meal. And you start seeing you get little hints of what Reconstruction is going to be like for the people of the South at the end of the book as well. It's so multifaceted. You can talk about this book from so many different directions. I think it's worthwhile to have in the classroom.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's a valuable resource, really, because you can look at it from so many different ways. Now, you mentioned that Leroy is politically astute. In terms of, and he's got, and I'm not going to ask you to divulge his favorite general, although I had planned on it. I'm not going to now, but,
Okay.
Yeah, you want to say, it's fine. That's fine. But he does talk about a lot.
That's a cute story.
Okay. You can, I'll leave it to you. If you want to tell the story, that's great. But if you want to save it for the readers, that's also cool. But he does talk about a bunch of different, you know, generals that we would know: Lincoln, Lee, McClellan, Johnston, Joseph Eggleston Johnston. These guys, they're all in there. You know, he mentions them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that he has a pretty decent working understanding of how the military, 19th century military works? You know, for such a young person.
I think, excuse me. I think at the beginning it's a little sketchy. But I think at the end, he's got a very good grasp of how this works, even to the point of blaming Jefferson Davis for some of his personal animosity towards specific generals and not putting the right man in the right place because he didn't like him. He does mention that. And even though he loves Jefferson Davis at the beginning, he talks about how well he speaks. He knows his whole pre-war record. He thinks that he says the Stevens, the Davis-Stevens ticket is a prime ticket. Well, the family was also connected. They knew Alex Stevens because the grandparents lived in Athens, which is where Stevens was from.
Right.
And he occasionally takes grandmother's mail to Richmond with him. So there's those high level connections, but I think he starts to understand how all of this pulls in together. For example, when Stonewall Jackson dies, he knows that that's going to be a big problem. You don't just replace a Stonewall Jackson. He had been too pivotal in his own right to be easily replaced. Mm-hmm. That's a huge tragedy for the South.
Right, right. That's really interesting stuff. I mean, reading through this and scanning through it again, I found that his understanding of the significance of military operations was beyond that I would expect for somebody this young. But of course, he had time, I suppose, to contemplate these things. And so he had, I think he's engaging some of these ideas in his diary. One of the last thing I wanted to ask you is about personal diaries and personal correspondence and how we as historians kind of become almost like voyeurs in a way, peering into people's lives and they had no intention for us to do so. Do you ever feel like you're, violating their privacy or anything like that? Or do you feel like we have a responsibility now that we have this information to share it with the rest of the world when they had no intention of doing so?
Tut and I had talked about that as we were working through the whole process. And we both kind of felt that he would be horrified to know that people were looking at this. And there's one, again, I clipped it out and I use it in PowerPoint presentations. He kept this book with him, I think, during the day. And somebody had scribbled lines at the top of it. And it could have been two people. A little girl named Florence, who was born the same day he had his leg accident, actually. She was the daughter of one of the housemaids. She was 5 years old. And then there was his cousin, Tracy, whose mother died before he was a year old. And his father, John Springs Baxter, was one of his mother's brothers. And he was a surgeon in the Georgia military. And so he was off at war. He was, he was being brought up communally by everybody. And so he would come up to the Gresham home. And I think it was Tracy who did the scribbling in the book. Mm-hmm. But occasionally Leroy writes, people shouldn't be looking in here. Don't read any further than this. And I think he would be initially horrified to know that we were looking at his private thoughts because some of them are so personal. But then I think if he thought about it and I thought about it too, to know that he was providing such insight into his life and his time and his unique experience to people 150 some years later, that would be valued, I think would, I think he'd be good with that.
Mm-hmm. I kind of feel the same way. I've spoken about things that I've read in people's personal correspondence, the intimate details between husband and wife, for example, that I don't think they want shared with the rest of the world. But then at the same time, I go, wait a second, now this is providing a great deal of insight into people's worldview, how patriarchies worked in the 19th century, various things like that. And and so I think that we have some sort of duty, I suppose, as educators and historians to share that. Just so we can provide a more comprehensive picture.
Yeah, even Dr. Rosbach in his introduction, my publisher writes an introduction, I write one, and then Dr. Rosbach wrote one, and he says it's the medical profession, they don't do this. They don't take someone's medical history and just, expose it like this. And you should, as you start reading this, you should realize that this is privileged information and it is of a sensitive nature, but we need to know about it. We need to know how far we've come medically. You know, this is a time period, again, no wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. Questions like, well, you know, he had this smashed leg. I'm often asked, why do you think they didn't amputate? I said, because that probably would have killed him.
Yeah.
To do that. They didn't understand about the basics of infection. They didn't understand that some of the medicines they were giving this kid were poisonous, mm-hmm. were addictive. One of the things I still can't get over is this compound called Dover's powder. Half of it is the dried compound, the active ingredient of syrup of ipecac. Mm-hmm. You have little kids. I had a little bottle like this, which it makes you throw up. Mm-hmm. So your kids get into something, you call the emergency room. They say, make them vomit, that you give them ipecac and it's, you know, everywhere. And the other half of it was morphine. Oy. And they used it for headaches, toothaches, little things. I'll take a little Dover's powder and I'm thinking, man, and they're mixing it like it's, you know, just like we use aspirin or Tylenol. Mm-hmm. And then I'm reading in Mary Chestnut's story about how her maid once put an entire packet of, it was, you know, sold in little packets, but an entire packet in a glass of wine. Mary Chestnut was out for 2 days.
Yeah, I'll bet you
would. She used this stuff really sparingly. So, you know, I've gone back and reread some journals. There's Mary Chestnut. Most people are familiar with her. I've read one written by Annie Froebel, who is from Northern Virginia in the Mount Vernon area, which was always occupied. She writes a very interesting journal about what it's like to be an occupied woman. And it turns out that her brother ended up being Thomas Gresham's superior officer.
Oh, wow.
Because I said, I know that name Froebel. And he drew the land map that we used when we were locating the Gresham plantations. Hmm. These interconnections are just so bizarre.
I know. Isn't that weird how that works out?
Yeah, yeah. And then Minnie married into a legal family. She had gone to Baltimore. She and her sister Seda, her cousin Seda, had gone to Baltimore after the war to further their education. And she married into a very prominent Fairfax County family. And the farmstead is a place I used to take my girls hiking when they were little.
Yeah.
And its story goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could talk about this, and, you know, you talk about the religious aspect. They were Presbyterians. You learn a lot about the Presbyterian church. Woodrow Wilson's father was in the house.
Oh, wow.
You know, and Ted and I went back and forth. And he said, why do you think that's important in a footnote? I said, because it shows these people are going to have connections into the future. And one of the last things that Thomas Gresham did in his life was get Minnie's friend, Mary Grace, blanking on her last name. Mm-hmm. He got her a position working in the Department of Statistics as a woman in the late 1800s. She was, again, like Minnie, she didn't marry. Minnie married, obviously. But she had a full career working in the Bureau of Statistics, looking at, this is my cat here, everybody.
Hi there. What's your cat name?
I'm a Cider, and she's tracking my other cat.
I see that. I'm quite the cat fan myself, as everyone knows. You see, on behind my ear, I have cat paw tattoos.
Oh gosh.
So I'm pretty serious about it.
Yeah, she's my buddy. She rips my hand up. But anyhow. Mary Grace, he got her a position, again, a federal position. Well, how could he do that? He didn't have federal connections after the war. So, and she ended up having an illustrious career of her own, working for the federal government, tracking the impact of work on women and children. in the early part of the 20th century.
That's really fascinating. I mean, you know, this is a time and in a place where women don't generally enter the workforce in that capacity. So super fascinating stuff. Well, Jan, this has been a really delightful conversation, fascinating stuff. The book is The War Outside My Window, The Civil War Diary of Leroy Wiley Gresham. You're the editor of it, published by Savas Beatty. And it comes, you can get a curriculum guide. If you're a teacher, this is actually a really wonderful resource to bring into the classroom. You know, it I think a book like this will get kids to challenge some of the things that they may assume about, you know, a life in Civil War Georgia, among a very, with a very privileged family. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. And I highly recommend it. So thank you very much for coming on the show to talk about it with us.
Well, I'm very glad to have been here, and I feel very, very blessed to have had the opportunity to bring this book out. Mm-hmm. People ask me, well, why didn't the Library of Congress publish it? Well, that's not their job.
Nope.
This was, you know, it's part of a larger collection of Minnie's, the family she married into. Mm-hmm. So it's a small part of a much larger collection. So it would be kind of hard to just locate on its own. Mm-hmm. But their purpose is to preserve, not to publish. And there were no publishing restrictions. They said nobody else had published it. And so Ted said, let's go.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad
Thank you
did. Thank you. You're welcome. And thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner. I am currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Allen in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War Letters of Henry A. Allen. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.